Okay, well, hi again. This is Bob Brundage. And today is February the 3rd. This is 2004. And today we're talking by a long-distance telephone to Bob Livingston back in Middletown, Connecticut. And I'm very interested in his experiences over the years and looking forward to presenting this tape to the Square Dance Foundation of New England. So, Bob, tell me a little bit about where you're born and brought up and a little bit of your early family history.
Well, I was born right here in Middletown back in 1937, and lived here most of my life. Spent a little time in Missouri and some time in Charleston, West Virginia, moving around. Never really had a career. I've done a little bit of everything, and now I'm in my 66th year. And I'm back in Middletown.
Good. Well, what was your early experiences? Did you come from a musical family or anything like that?
No, not at all. The only thing we had in the house was a record player. I listened to back in the 1940s, I guess, was cowboy music.
Yeah.
My folks listened to the big band music of the day.
Uh-huh.
What was on the radio.
And right.
We never had, my family was involved with fraternal work, and they were involved with the Masonic and the Eastern Star fraternities.
Yes.
As far as going out and dancing or nightclubbing or socializing in that way, we just sort of had a normal upbringing. Myself and my younger sister, we went to whatever activities were in school and in the church.
Right.
The Boy Scouts and that sort of thing.
Okay, what was your introduction to square dancing?
Well, Being in Middletown, it was there. There was Bradley's Barn, which I guess went every Friday night. And so square dancing itself was still a public event that people could participate in. And it was just maybe sort of fading out at the time that I was getting out of high school in the middle 50s in this area. It seemed... It was quite strong when Middletown was about 25,000 people, and all the little towns around it were rural. But now we're situated halfway between New Haven and Hartford, and that's pretty well been what they call urban sprawl. It's pretty well filled in, and as the farmers sold off their fields for house lots, it seems that activities like square dancing faded. So I was certainly aware of it, and when I was 16, being an active member of the Masonic sponsored youth group, the Order of D. Malay, we ran a refreshment kitchen in the Masonic Temple because for one season anyway, somebody, and I don't know who, rented the place and had what they called Eastern traditional square dancing there on Friday nights. So I would go down there and work the kitchen and watch the band and the callers and the dancers. It seemed like it was a young crowd, maybe a little bit older than I was. I was maybe like a sophomore, junior in high school.
Right. But do you remember the caller that called there?
I've sort of asked and tried to find out some background on that place, and I've had a hard time. And it might have been a fellow by the name of Hank Post.
Oh, yeah, I know Hank.
Yeah. He was, I guess, quite active in this area.
Right.
And, at that time, I guess there were a few people that were active in that area, throughout Connecticut. It was still, there was a place down not too far from us in Guilford, and Uncle Dave's.
Oh, yes.
And I knew people, as I say, I never participated, but I knew folks that would go down there and young people that would go down there.
Right.
So I was aware of square dancing. I was and still am a fan of the country music, and more of the country music of that day than what's played on the radio today.
Right.
And my wife and I, back when I was maybe, well, we got married when I was 30, and she was 4 years younger, and about five times. During that time, we went down to the Grand Ole Opry, and we enjoyed just watching the performances,
right,
square dancing on the Grand Ole Opry.
Right.
I even took something away from that later on to use in calling, and going to following regional bands. In Connecticut on a Saturday night, we'd go to a local restaurant or night spot to hear a local band, and once in a while there was one place over in Woodbury, the Old Tollgate Inn, and somebody from the band would get up and call a set of squares every once in a while.
Right.
But we just watched it. It was energetic. There was a lot of swinging, and the people were young. But I had no connection with it. Until we had moved to Charleston, West Virginia, and I was a radio DJ down there for a while.
How were you?
And when we came back, we took an apartment in just over the Middletown line into Durham, and my wife saw an ad in the paper, or a little write-up in the social news, stating that there were square dance lessons. Starting at the cafeteria in the local high school. So off we went. We took 20 weeks of square dance lessons with Tony DiCarlo.
Oh, yes.
From the Cross Trailers Club in the Meriden. And so we were charter members of the Durham Square Dance Club. And quite active. We filled a century book in a year, and we filled a second one a couple of years after that. But the thing that sort of separated maybe us from others in the class, we had not yet had a family started. We have one son who did not come along until I was almost 40 years old. And so at that time, there was just the two of us, and we square danced two, three, four nights a week. And we graduated in June and got the New England Caller magazine. And at that time, you could go through it and find traditional dancing. And so we saw an ad for Dudley Laughlin calling contra dances in Amherst, Massachusetts.
There you go.
At the Episcopal Church there on the Green. And so we went up to a couple of his dances, and we would end up then in Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire, and dance at Duke Miller.
Oh, yeah.
So at the same time that we were dancing the club stuff, we were participating a little bit with the contras and square dancing in the traditional vein.
Right. Well, when did you get interested in calling then?
At that time, a lot of the clubs in the area would have an amateur caller's night. And I happened to have a little stack of records because America's Square Dance magazine or somebody said if you send them a couple of bucks, they'd send you potluck, just a stack of them.
Oh, yeah.
I just had them hanging around. And so I took them and just participated in the amateur caller night, as, you know, many people did at that time. And Charlie Underwood had become the club caller for the Durham Club, and he was looking to put together a caller's class for himself, working out of the garage in his house over the summer break. So he recruited me and three or four other people, and Monday nights we would go down there, and he started teaching me the basics, I guess, of modern Western square dance calling.
Oh, that's great.
So I just continued from there. The following summer, I went to Dick Ledger's school up in Rutland, Vermont, and that's the only formal school that I ever went to.
Okay, that was to be another one of my questions. So, well, that's really great. But then somewhere along the line, you got a little disenchanted with modern Western, and you started concentrating on pretty much the traditional or the one-night stand type of thing, right?
Well, I got, so I was teaching the classes at with the Durham Club. Charlie Underwood was the caller, and we would camp a little bit and up and down into southern Vermont and over to New Hampshire and western Massachusetts, and I got picked up calling dates, not because I had a great reputation as a caller, but we just sort of got out and met a lot of people, and I got on a lot of calendars, and so we were calling fairly busy. I never was a club caller. I've taught for a couple of clubs and had these guest dates. And then one Friday night, I was to call at the Green Mountain Squares in Brattleboro, Vermont, about 100 miles north of home. And they say it was on a Friday, and we were halfway up there, and I got off the interstate 91 and swung down into Northampton, and on a commercial building there was a marquee on the top of it advertising that one town over in Williamsburg, Mass, the following night at the Grange Hall was to be Eastern Style Traditional Square Dance. It just set up there, Square Dance Barty's Orchestra, Bergie Grange, and I decided I would go to it. So I left my wife home the next night and went up there to check it out. And I was just thrilled with the live music. He had a trumpet in the band and a guitar player who plays with me now with the Falltown String Band, and a drummer and a terrific lady on the piano. And the place was full. There was quite a core of active dancers that showed up. I guess they had them twice a month. At the break, I went over and talked to him, and I told him who I was, and like a lot of people who were callers, I told him how good I was, and that I was up into Vermont, and called dances up there, and I'd call them in Western Mass, and I was teaching classes in Connecticut, and it was all club stuff, and he just walked me over to his guitar player, and he said, well, you tell him what keys you want, and you can get up and call a set of dances after the break. And first I said I would, and then I thought about it and put my tail between my legs and went home. I realized there's no way I could get up there and do that.
I see.
So I kind of learned a lesson. Driving home, I said, now who's the caller here? I'm the one that knows 100 calls and had some formal training, and he's just the guy that gets up there and calls the same dances every week, and people come in and they haven't taken any lessons either, and the music is for real, it's not canned, and everybody has a good time. And so I kind of started from there. I didn't go back to his dance until I knew three or four of them, because he got me up on stage again. But about the same time,
Who's that caller, by the way?
Charlie Bardwell.
Oh yeah, Charlie Bardwell.
Right, and he had broken off, he said, way back from a fella. He played drums for Corky Calkins.
Yes.
And Corky Calkins had started a club called the Valley Swingsters in Holyoke. And Corky Caucus had passed on. And
yes.
He passed on just about the time that we graduated from in 1971 as club dancers. And we saw an ad again in the New England Caller that there was a benefit dance for his family at the up at the University of Massachusetts. So we went to that dance. So we met callers there that were both club callers and some of the traditional callers.
Right.
And, but a fella came to me and told me that this club that Corky Caucus had started, the Valley Swingsters, danced every Sunday evening, every fourth Sunday of the month. At a church in Holyoke, Mass. And I started going up there. And they had rotating callers. One of them was Ray Gay, who lives in Holyoke. And I can't think of everybody's name. George Hodson was,
yes.
was another one.
I knew George.
And as they had to leave or passed on, eventually I ended up calling for them. And the last two callers, we would take turns, would be George Hodson and myself. But this was an opportunity to use recorded music, and then on New Year's Eve and in the spring, they would have a live band come in. And that's where I got some taste of live music.
All right.
And, then the one caller there, Ray Gay, has said that besides this gig, he had another one up in East Massachusetts, which is on the Vermont line off Route 2 of the Mohawk Trail, and a little town high up in the hills, about 20 miles off the interstate out of Greenfield, Mass, at the town hall or community center. And it was a little bit too far for me to get there. It was maybe 120 miles from my home, so I never got there while he was calling, but he developed a cancer, which eventually took his life. And people who went to that dance would tell me when they were down at the Valley Swingsters that Ray Gay would be calling a dance and couldn't get through the evening, and that this young fellow that was sitting in the band by the name of Doug Wilkins came forth and because he was sitting in the band, had just picked up some of the calls by rote and filled in for him. And Doug Wilkins was taking over more and more, and eventually, when Ray had to give it up, and then he passed away shortly after that, Doug, who was only in his 20s, he was a school teacher from the Boston area, and decided to move to a rural area. He moved out here and took a job teaching at the regional high school. He was scrambling around trying to find, put together enough of the old-time Eastern dances to continue the program. They danced every first and third Saturday. And so I met him at a Charlie Bardwell dance, and he told me he'd gotten about 17 dances, enough to get him through an evening, and I eventually started going up there. And he continued the dances for 15 years, and he gave me a lot of time on the stage. He started a family, and he got involved with more and more outside activities. Was calling on me more and more to fill in. So by the time by 1998, after 15 years, he decided he didn't want to do it anymore. And so that's when the dancing stopped up there. It was a little bit too far for me to do on a regular basis. And he kept it going and gave me a lot of, that's really, I was sort of apprenticed there because it was live music all the time.
Right.
That and it was that band there that, like in the summer of '84, was actually my first my first gig where I called a dance myself, the town of Cummington, Mass., had hired the band from Heath to do a summer dance at their pavilion in the park. And Doug Wilkins wanted to pass on it, so he asked me to do it. And it was my very first time to call a dance. 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock.
Yeah, 4 hours. Okay.
So then, from then on, I just sort of, that's where my attention went to. I joined the Connecticut Callers in 1975, and it happened that Ralph Page was doing the program that day.
Huh.
And it was the only time I ever met him in person. And then in 1976, another fellow made an impression on me was Harold Hart up in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We went up to, in August, to the CNE, Canadian National Exhibition, which is a large, they call it the largest fair in North America.
Uh-huh.
And as we were going in, we saw these groups of square dancers that looked like they were a club. They had red and white uniforms on. There was a live band, and this fella, who was Harold Hart, was calling. And so I talked to him. And this, I had just maybe been calling a year or so. This was 76. And he knew Dick Ledger. And I guess he'd gone to a Maine folk dance camp, which was... I can't think of the fellow. Ralph Page maybe had something to do with that.
Yes.
At one time. And we got back to Toronto. We'd go up there in the 80s. They had dancing in the park Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. They had live music, and Harold Hart would call. And the music was so smooth, it sounded exactly like the Sets in Order label records. And to listen to it on tape, it was so professional that it sounded like it was recorded music and not live music.
Right.
And they were really terrific. And he would let me get up and call a tip or so. Eventually, I joined the Old Time Callers Association up there. In fact, I ordered a book from them, and then I went up there in the summer, and they gave me the book and said they owed me some money. I had sent them too much, and they said, "Well, we'll just put you on our roster." And I said, "Well, you know, that's fine." And then I was reading their bylaws later, and I said, you know, I'm not on their roster as a caller. Anybody who's interested in preserving their old-time square dancing can join, whether you're a caller or not. But they said, in order to have a little C, a small case after your name, on their membership list, you had to get up and call one singing call and one reel and one jig. So I made specifically went up to one of their dancers just to do that. So I was, I enjoyed their, I find that the, even with the French quadrilles and the singing calls and the old time Eastern dances that were done throughout New England, and the type of patter. They use phrase music, but they don't really, they don't give the call in advance of the beat. They sort of have a chant, which you're probably well aware of. But it's just these 8-beat chants, but it's all the same route, the figures.
Yes.
Basically, it's just different styles of the same thing, and it's all community dancing.
Right.
So I enjoyed some of that style.
Right. Well, tell me about your Bernardston, Massachusetts dance.
Well, 1987, a fellow by the name of Ed Phelps.
Ed South?
Phelps.
Phelps.
Decided to put together some local musicians and form a community band, and it's sort of a open-ended organization. Whoever wants to sit in for any gig can be part of the band for that gig. And of course, there are some core members, and they would play for just any event in town, or any little church social, or weddings and anniversaries, nursing homes, and some places they got paid, some places they didn't for nothing. And he was a school teacher in the English department at the high school in Greenfield, and in the beginning, and he's since retired, and I guess he's in his later 60s. And he remembered as they say, the culture, because it's more of a rural area up there, lingered longer, and there was more of a core of people who either still danced or remember dancing than there were in Connecticut, which was becoming maybe citified quicker than it was further north. And he got the town hall, and it's the same town hall where I called my first club dance. My first club dance was as a guest caller with the State Line Stompers. Ted Cromack was the caller.
Oh, I remember Ted, yeah.
That club gave me my first chance to call a dance. First dance I got paid for. They started holding monthly dances at the town hall in Bernardston. And it's just been going on we're in our 17th year.
Okay, well, didn't you do some filming at one of those dances?
Some filming?
Yeah.
Yeah, I videotaped.
Videotape, right.
Quite a bit.
I know you sent some back here to the Lloyd Shaw Dance Archives, and I had the pleasure of seeing them. They were very interesting. So, have you done a great deal of that videotaping your dances?
What I do is I put a little cassette in the camcorder.
Yeah.
And it might take months to go to put 2 hours on it.
I see.
Because it'll be sitting there next to me, and I don't. When I first bought it, I taped a large part of the dance, and to watch it later on was like watching grass grow.
Yeah.
And so now it's like if somebody showed you a dozen photographs, and then the photographs just moved for two, 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And if I see, I'll pick it up and maybe just take a shot of the band or the outside building and just pan them. Or then just a short pan of the crowd, or then maybe just to watch one figure or watch people swing or do a jitterbug. Just little takes. And I take them while I'm calling, so I've got the microphone in one hand and the camcorder in the other hand.
Right.
So sometimes I have to just stop it and attend to calling the band. And so sometimes they get cut off where they shouldn't be. So I've got a lot of these little pieces as they accumulate, and I'm not sure what to do with them. I'm sort of negotiating with my son. We don't know how to get them on DVDs or something more permanent than the tape that they're on.
Right. Well, you should make sure that somehow they get into the Square Dance Foundation of New England's archives, to be preserved there. in some form, or either in the camcorder version or the DVD. So I encourage you to do that. I think you also connected with some French Canadian dancing down in Rhode Island.
Yes.
Is that something on a regular basis?
Yeah, that is. A year after the dances started with the Fall Town String Band in Burnerton, Massachusetts, the Grange Hall in Killingly, which is right on the Rhode Island line, asked me to call and dance, and then they continued it, and we're in our 16th year over there. But they have that really wasn't something that was a startup, because I think they were active enough that if they didn't have a monthly, I think they became monthly after I started calling, but they would have them intermittently with Irvander and other callers, Harold West, whoever was still active in the Eastern Connecticut at that time. And I had gone over there just to dance one night when Harold West was to call. And actually, Irvander was to call, and Harold West was filling in for him and wasn't used to the band. And I had a list of calls, and I said, check off the ones you know, and then I'll do some of the others. But the stuff that everybody knows, like Red River Valley, are just because I won't do them because you know them. And so I guess I did enough, so the next time they had a dance, they asked me if I would do it. And so it became a regular thing. And 15 miles away, over the line, Lori Morin has a Modern Western Square Dance Club.
Right.
To Patrick.
Yes.
Some of the, I went over to dance at her club, and she asked me to get up and do a guest set, which I did. And at the end of the dance, one of her dancers came through, shaking hands, and said, you know, that the dance you did was like a French quadrille. And I said, oh, do you dance French quadrilles? And she said, oh, we have one tomorrow in Providence. He told me where it was, and I took a ride over there. And the caller there, George Menard, asked me to get up and do one, and I did. And then I went back. They were being done monthly. And after three or four, he decided to retire and handed me a sheet of dances. So I'm doing those.
Okay.
Once a month on Sunday afternoons.
Right.
These are at the Blackstone River Theater, they...
A couple of minutes ago, I'm sorry we lost part of that, but so let's continue now. We're talking with Bob Livingston back in Connecticut. We were just talking about the French Canadian dances just across the line in Rhode Island. So here we go again, Bob.
Okay, I'll give you a little quick rundown then on the French Canadian dances.
Yeah.
One of the members of the French Canadian community is a modern Western square dance dancer, and he told me about these dances, and I went over there and participated as a dancer and would get up and do a guest call. And eventually the caller there, George Menard, he actually was in his 70s and is a widower, recently remarried to a woman who was a widow but not interested in spending her Sunday doing quadrilles. And I guess she's still French. And he passed the baton to me. And so I've been doing them, and we got a grant to split so we could sit down and he could give me some of the background and the history and why these quadrilles are done the way they're done in Rhode Island.
I see. Well, tell me, you're doing mostly one-night stand type of thing outside of these regular traditional type dances around in Connecticut, right?
Well, it's every second Saturday in Killingly and fourth Saturday in Berniston, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And usually fourth Sunday at the quadrilles in Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And the especially the band, the Fall Town String Band in Berniston, they get quite a few extra dates, home days during the summer, and anniversaries and weddings. We've done weddings and even a restaurant or two or supper club.
Sure.
They play and they'll maybe have me come in and we'll see if we get some people up and do a set or so.
Right.
And there's also the Heath Fair has square dancing in the summer, and the Cummington Fair. These are small fairs, but full fairs with rides and all.
Right.
And they've continued having squares. West Hampton, Mass. This summer had a lower town, maybe a 300th or 200th anniversary celebration over a weekend, and we had a big dance there in the high school, and quite a few people came to that.
Right.
So there's these people still, when they think of community dancing, they think of it as the way it was back when that's all there was. You know, when it was just what they say is Eastern dancing. They don't think of it as the club dancing.
Right.
Because the club dancing in that area, and we used to dance with all the clubs up there, they've come and they've gone.
Sure.
Yeah. And so the clubs that are left are more regional rather than local. One club in each little community.
Yes. Well, that's very interesting. Just a matter of interest, do you have any other hobbies that you do?
This is it.
That's it.
follow the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and see how the politics of the world is going. I enjoy music, and we go to shows, and bluegrass shows.
Right. Yeah.
My son is, when he went to school in the middle of Pennsylvania at Bucknell, they had just started a contra dance group there.
Huh.
And so I got to do a contra session, one of their dances, got on their schedule. There, and then also found that the live music Eastern Square there was still strong, and the Saturday nights you could go out, and because it's a rural area, that people were still dancing.
Good.
And they weren't necessarily an older crowd. They were younger people there, and they were dancing because their parents were there, and maybe they won't do it all their lives.
Yeah.
But you can still look on the floor and see people in their 30s and teenagers.
Oh, that's great. Well, I assume from what you've been telling me that you're not concerned about the death of square dancing as you know it. You seem to be, I think you feel that you're going to keep busy until you want to retire, right?
There's a reality, and I think it's true. You need, it's like a pump out in the farmyard. You need that jug of water to pour in it.
Yeah.
Before you, prime, you know, to prime it.
Prime it.
And if you don't have that jug of water, you're not going to get the rest of it.
Right.
And that jug of water for square dancing happens to be the old-time dancers.
Right.
that core comes, and if, as long as there's a Grange Hall that is doesn't that sponsors it, so there's no heavy overhead and willing workers and band members, people will come of all ages and they'll have a good time, but they won't necessarily come every week. It's not in their blood like the old people. And so I say, if there's three squares, your number one square, how many people in the community do you need to make up your number one square? You need eight people, because that number one square is going to come to every dance.
Right.
The square behind them, you need two people, because those are the, that's the square, or, I mean, you need 16, because you need two squares worth.
Uh-huh.
That square are those people that come every other dance.
Right.
And then the third square, the people that come every once in a while. So maybe you need, you know, 16 squares of people that might come casually to make up that third square.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a very nice analogy. Well,
I still pay my dues to the
Connecticut Callers.
Yes, I'm active with them, and with NECA.
Okay.
And I do programs for live music through the NECA specialist program.
Right.
And I've done a couple of those. But what I was thinking of, the Durham Club that I joined, I still pay the dues.
Oh, yeah.
But I very rarely get to a dance.
Sure.
They've had Lori Moore on the schedule the past couple of years, and she's on it this year. And it'll be a mainstream dance, and I'll get there.
Right.
And when that club was founded, it was everybody lived in the community. And now the club is still doing fairly well, but it's a regional club. People are maybe come from a 30-mile circle all around it. They're from the shore. They're from Hartford. They're from over in the Meriden-Wallingford area. They're from east of the river or towards the East Saddam and such. And Durham is a, if I go to the library, if I go to the independent market in the center of Main Street, I meet the people who have come through the lessons through the years, and some of them that were in my classes. And they, this community that was built is where I've made lifelong friends, even though we maybe haven't danced together in over 20 years.
Right.
There's no way that they can participate in that anymore, because they can't just drop off and then come back in.
Right.
Without going through a lot of workshopping and really dedicating themselves to become the plus dancer to dance, you know, with that club. When the club started, it was, well, if you hopped on the lessons in September, it was a community service to take the lessons, and if they stayed at maybe 50, 75 at that time in the early 70s, that they would have dropped out and come back.
Yeah.
But they finally can't come back now.
I see, right. You know. No, you're so right. Well, Bob, I think this has been a very, very interesting conversation, and I appreciate your taking the time to put down your thoughts. You've given me a beautiful analogy of what the future of square dancing in your eyes would be.
I add one more thing.
Yes, sir.
About that.
Sure.
It has the potential and promise to survive, but... you're aware of, like, river dance?
Yes.
Which they say revived Irish dancing.
Right.
But I don't really say that it has, because people sit in the seats and watch it.
Right.
They don't participate in it.
Yep.
And when I go and call a community square dance, it's the community is still dancing. And I don't know if it'll survive. It'll probably survive in some form, and it'll always but I don't see. It's up in the air whether I think it could survive, because there is a percentage of the population, even though everybody is a couch potato, so they say, and I'm one too, in a lot of ways. But there is a percentage of the population that is very active in many different pursuits. And I think there are people that would participate in, with other things in square dancing, as long as it's there. But if it's not what they want, they're not going to do something else to save it. They're just going to walk away from it.
Well, that's great. So, Bob, let's call it an evening then. And again, I thank you very much for your taking the time to get your thoughts down on tape. And I'll be sending this up to the Square Dance Foundation in New England. And if I ever get back to Connecticut, I'll try to get around to one of your dances.
Well, good deal. You said you saw one of these, some of my video.
Yes.
And it was at the New England Foundation.
No, it was at the Lloyd Shaw Dance Archives.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember that I sent it.
Oh, yes, you did. Yep.
I did.
Yep.
Why did I send it?
Well,
I don't remember doing that.
Okay. I know. I think me, either my request or Bill Litchman. We were trying to stock up things for the archive, and that was, but I did see them, and they're at the archive still, which has been forwarded up to the University of Denver. But so anyway, thank you again, and I'll hope to see you around the square.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Okay, Bob. Good night.